Good evening, everyone. Everyone awake and ready? Great. It's lovely to be here speaking about truth. Satsang means association, coming together to discuss truth, to realize truth is the greatest thing. Reading from Papa Ram Dass, Communion with Your Eternal Beloved. What is there sweeter in the world than to hold communion with your eternal beloved? He is your never-failing companion and friend. He resides in the inner chamber of your heart and is also present everywhere about you. He is the soul, your life of your life. In the absolute sense, you and he are one. If this love of intimate comradeship with your beloved does not inspire your life, even if you have all other things, your life is lived in vain. See your beloved in the face of all beings and creatures. Verily, he has become the whole universe. Wherever you turn, there he is. The bliss of his presence is inexpressible. Why run away from him and seek to attain peace in aloofness? Allow your life to mingle with his life. That is the universal life. He is a calm, serene, changeless spirit. And at the same time, he is a world player. He dances in the hearts of all beings and creatures. He is at once wisdom, power, and love. How wonderful are the images in which he appears. He is the essence of all grandeur and majesty. He is the smile on the face of the innocent child and the power that sits on the brow of the king. He is the love that bubbles in the heart of a saint. He is the radiance that shines upon all creation. Who can describe his greatness? Why talk of him in terms of abstract philosophy, while he is the very nectar which you can drink and enjoy? He permeates your physical frame and tingles in every atom of it. You are wise, you are well-read, and you have gone through spiritual practices. You have put on the garb of sanctity, and you can preach and you can pose. These are all nothing if you do not experience the blissful union with the beloved. You can meet him in the streets, in the bazaar, on the hills, in the cottages of the poor, in the palaces of kings and jungles and workshops and offices, at all places. He is with you. How sweet, how charming is his constant company. Why do you miss him? Be humble. Reduce yourself to the very dust of his feet, but dwell in him and be enchanted by his company. Lay aside your pride. What are you worth if you do not have him? You may sit on an eminence, but without him you cannot be happy. You may own millions, but without his smile beaming on your face, you are poor indeed. Enrich your life by his light, love, and joy. How sweet and how great he is. Seek the beloved. Feel his presence. He is thy own self. Have him at any cost. Find him and enjoy eternal felicity. That is why you are here. And reading from the Gospel of St. Thomas. We are familiar with the four Gospels within the Bible, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. But there were many other writings and teachings from the early days of Christianity, even from the very beginning. And the Gospel of Thomas is one of them. It's a very interesting thing that the name Thomas itself is not a proper name. It means twin. And the notion, the idea was that even as Jesus was, so Didymus, who was known as Thomas, could become his twin, could become as he was, could rise up into that kingdom of heaven, identify himself with I and my Father are one. And therefore there is a kindredness of spirit between all the great teachers, no matter how great, even the great avatars, and their disciples and those who follow after them. And so Thomas writes, his disciples asked, "Teach us about the place where you dwell, for we must seek it." He told them, "Those who have ears, let them hear. There is light within people of light, and they shine it upon the whole world. If they do not shine it, what darkness?" Yeshua, or Jesus, said, "Love your brother and your sister as your own soul. Protect them as you do the pupil of your own eye." Yeshua said, "So you see the sliver in your brother's eye, but you do not see the log in your own eye. When you remove the log from your eye, then you will see clearly enough to remove the sliver from your brother's eye. If you do not fast from the world, you will not find the kingdom. If you do not celebrate the Sabbath as a Sabbath, you will not know the Father. I stood in the midst of the world and revealed myself to them in the flesh. I found them all intoxicated. Not one of them was thirsty. And my soul grieved for the children of humanity, for they are blind in their hearts. They do not see. They came naked into the world, and naked they will leave it. At this time they are intoxicated. When they have vomited their wine, they will return to themselves." Whether we study the saints and the masters of the East or the West, we get some common messages from either one of them. Whether it is Papa Ramdas or whether it is Jesus, whether it is Saint Francis or whether it is Rama, Krishna, Buddha, any of the great ones. And we will see that they are all directing our minds in the same way. We have become intoxicated with this world, drunk, as it were, with the senses. It is interesting when somebody leaves this body and what kind of consciousness they leave it with. If someone is a drug addict or an alcoholic and they leave the body, they leave with that craving for that substance. And since that substance is something that is acquired here on earth, anything of the senses that is acquired here and a liking for it and attachment for it will draw that person back into this earthly realm. And for some, they never leave it. They have no interest in going into a light or a kingdom of light or a being of light. They want only what they want, which is their craving. And so such a soul will leave this body and it will wander perhaps back to its familiar haunts where it imbibed what made it intoxicated. And it will attach itself to another soul there. And as a result of that, it will try to gain that intoxication, that quality that is induced when it has alcohol or drugs of any nature. It also coincides with people who perhaps are cozied up to a bar stool, and there they sit, and their egos are extremely weakened by the drugs, so they're open to these spirits that are trying to find some access to their habit. And so instead of going free from this body, going free from this earth, rising into a greater spirit, they bind themselves to another soul. They bind themselves to this world, and there they stay until perhaps their karma calls them back and they are reborn into the body of a baby. But what do you think, what kind of baby will they come into? Certainly, they will be most strongly drawn into the womb of a mother who herself is an alcoholic or a drug addict, and so they are born with fetal alcohol syndrome or some other addiction already in their system. What a rough way to go. Extremely difficult. And so we find that we go round and round in this world, and whatever it is that draws us the most powerfully is what we go to. It just stands to reason. If you take somebody who is used to, for instance, say, perhaps a very head-banging kind of rock and roll, and then you play for them some kind of classical music, and they won't like it. They'll want to get away with it. There's a time when the different stores, 7-Eleven stores and stores like that, that stayed open all night, and they would get these people hanging around the outside of the store, and other people wouldn't come into the store because these guys looked kind of rough around the edges. So they started playing classical music, and suddenly they just disappeared. It was like fingernails on chalkboard for them. They didn't like it. So your nature is determined by the kinds of things that you are drawn to. And for those who are called upon a spiritual path, you are drawn into a spiritual vibration, which is very definitely different than this worldly vibration. Now, we still live in a world. But while living in that world, we feel drawn to something higher, something greater within ourselves. We don't always have a name or a word for it. But we know that we hunger for something beyond this world, beyond the senses. And we begin to have some experience with it and open ourselves to it. But we must disgorge the old wine, as Jesus said, in a very picturesque kind of way here, before we're able to imbibe the new wine. And in another place, he says that the old, you don't pour new wine into an old wineskin, because that wineskin will burst. You have to get a new wineskin. So you get a new body in Christ. Now, what does this mean? It means that as you go through these spiritual experiences, these awakening of this kundalini within your own spine, this tremendously powerful, transformative spiritual force that starts to rise up inside of you, it begins to change you, it attunes you to this higher spiritual power. We're actually inundated, we're in an ocean of spiritual bliss and spiritual power all the time. And yet we do not have the eyes nor the ears to see it or hear it or experience it in any way. But as we rise up, we begin to change. And I remember a time in my early years when I would anticipate going to some party and there would be loud music and dancing and all the rest of it. And I would just get excited inside. Oh, this is going to be great. And then my life began to change, and I began to go more deeply into the spiritual. And now that very same thing that excited me before became painful to me. It was difficult for me to be around that. And what I was drawn to was the spiritual vibration. And that was what drew me. That's what I wanted and yearned and hungered for more. And so my antenna, you might say, in a way that you can tune in to a particular radio station or a television station with an antenna, my antenna began to change from this world to spirit. And I still, there was times when I would be drawn to the things of this world. And that is our sadhana, that's our spiritual practice, and it's an up and down thing. Because for a while we experience the spiritual, and in the beginning we're very enthusiastic, and it's a honeymoon period. We're just so excited about what the possibilities are. And then these things of the world begin to come around, and they draw us out. And if we go with that, and we don't keep up our sadhana, we don't keep up our spiritual practice, we can get seduced back into this world. That is what keeping the Sabbath means. The Sabbath is the day that God rested. And Jesus in here says, you keep the Sabbath, that's the Sabbath. And what does it mean for God to rest? He goes out and he creates through the six days or six different aspects of creation. And then on the seventh, he rests. Now, internally, this means that we have these six chakras, these energy centers, these places of consciousness within our spine and our brain. And we create. We go out through this body. And we create the things of this world, and we can create toward the sixth heaven even. But it's not until we get into the seventh heaven that we get into a true state of rest. This morning, Peter and I were meditating together, and God gave me a wonderful image, and what he showed me was a light bulb that was clear. And you could see this light bulb and the two little filaments that were coming up from the base, and they came up, and then at the top was a much more convoluted and complex twisting of these filaments. And as the current passed into this light bulb, it would light up these two filaments going all the way up to the top, and then it was most lit at the top. And in the same way, you have this spiritual life force that comes in through the base of the spine. And it lights up the filament, these two filaments of the Ida and the Pingala. They're the two aspects, the two spiritual currents that are within your spine. And one represents the heat and the other the cool. One the inside, the other the outside. The one the upward kind of current, the other is the alternating descending current. And when you create a vacuum of peace and stillness that is produced through your spiritual practice, then this filament begins to glow with a light. And in the beginning, you see that light within yourself. You see it within your third eye point, within the ajna. And then you see it within the head. Your whole head becomes illumined with this. There is a time when I was just going to sleep at night, and every night I would turn my light off. I'd close my eyes, and I would see this bright light shining, and I'd think, oh, I didn't turn the light off, which, of course, I knew that I did, but I'd open my eyes and reach for the light, and the room was completely dark. And then I would close my eyes again, and my whole interior would become illumined with this light. And it was as if there was a sky high over me, and it was all filled with this beautiful, beautiful light. And so I would sit in wonder and in marvel as I wondered and looked upon this light within me. Now, this isn't unique to me. This is something that we can all experience, and it's the light within your own being. And isn't that a marvelous thing? Every one of these truths that have been taught down through thousands and thousands of years will bear themselves out if they are true. It is like mathematics. It doesn't matter which region of this world you come from, what your language is, the mathematics will be the same. It is universally true, you might say. How much even more so is spiritual truth? And so we are all called to a particular spiritual path, and that may be a particular religion, it may be a particular teacher, but we find a way. We must do that, you know, because otherwise we just get lost in a quagmire. And so we focus our attention upon the techniques that are given to us. And we follow that way. And we follow it with dedication and purity of spirit and purity of mind. And gradually, gradually, your whole being gets transformed. You are born again. You are born again, literally. You get new wineskin. You get a new skin of a body. Every cell of your body becomes charged with the spiritual energy and this consciousness. Isn't that a magnificent thing? And so you have to disgorge yourself of the old wine before you can imbibe the new wine. This new body needs to be built. This is quite a task, you know. It's not a simple thing. And so you are taken up, and you are put through different movements as this tremendous force erupts up through your spine. And I was made to move in different directions. And in the Old Testament, it talks about moving from so many cubits to this direction and that direction. And what it's talking about is that as this force rises up in the spine, it is looking to make straight the way, as John the Baptist talked about, to make straight the way. Your spine is straight. The passageway within your spine needs to become straight and cleared out of all debris. Everything that is not of God. And so even your physical body begins to move. And I was made to dance in different ways. And I would get up and I move in this direction and that direction and move around in a dance-like quality. And there were times when it was really challenging because it would take over at times when I was in public. And there was many times when I was in a store and in different places. And suddenly this magnetic force would take me over. And I was made to move in this direction, and then I would have to stop. And then I would have to turn in another direction, and I have to go in a certain direction that way. And so many pieces. And it was very, very exacting. And if I went outside of that, or tried to go outside of it, or tried to stop it, it became very painful. And so I had to enact this, and it didn't make any difference who was looking on, what they may have thought of me, anything else. I had to let all of that go. I remember one time I was in a beautiful bookstore down in Pioneer Square, Elliott Bookstore. And suddenly this magnetic force took me over and it made me go up some steps. And I got about a third of the way up the steps and I had to turn around and I had to come back down. And I thought, well, anybody who's watching me is really getting a show here, you know, because I'm not in control of this. And it would look strange, but nobody seemed to call the police or the manager or have me arrested or anything, so I guess it wasn't too noticeable. So here I am. And it was 15 or 20 minutes of moving in this particular way. And I had to surrender myself to it. But it's an intelligent energy because at another time, I was in another store that was on three stories. I was there with another person, and I wondered where the other person had gone off to. And so I was, all of a sudden, this magnetic force took me over, took me up through the escalators, through three floors, took me to an area that I would normally never go to, and I was just made to stand there and to stare. And suddenly, the person came out of the dressing room exactly where I was looking on the floor, exactly as perfectly placed to find that person, and then I was released from that energy. Isn't that an interesting thing? So this is perfect. It's beautiful. But we have to surrender ourselves to it, you see. And for some of us, and for me, one of the hardest things was, what would somebody else think? You know, would somebody else have a judgment of me? Would they think, perhaps I was insane, perhaps I was crazy, perhaps I was disturbed in some way? I had to let all of that go. One time I was down at Self-Realization Fellowship headquarters, Mount Washington. And I had kind of snuck onto the grounds with another person before their official opening time. But the gate was open, and so I thought, well, if the gate's open, I'll go ahead and go in. Went up by the wishing well there that's covered by a building now, but at that time it wasn't. Suddenly this magnetic force took me over, and it made me close my eyes and begin to walk backwards. And so I walked around the wishing well three times forwards, and then I walked three times around backwards with my eyes closed. And I had no idea where I was going or why I was going. And then it took me backwards, walking backwards with my eyes closed, down a sidewalk, across the street, down the street, around some tennis courts, all the way around, mind you, all with my eyes closed, didn't run into anything, didn't have any problems of any sort. But the other person became highly anxious because it was such a strange thing, and we were there at a time when technically we weren't supposed to be there. And so they left because they couldn't, they didn't like it anymore. And so they left, and I came around the tennis courts and back up to this wishing well, where Master's handprints and his footprints and Sister Gyanamata's handprints and footprints are there as well. And three times I walked around backwards and then three times forwards, and then I was released by this magnetic force. Now, these are very strange things. And yet, they served a great purpose. Number one, they worked on my own ego. Could I surrender to that experience in the moment? Could I trust in it? And I had to trust, you know, when your eyes are completely closed and you're walking backwards, you have no choice. It's like one of those things that they do where you're with a group and you fall backwards and you fall into some people's arms and you have to trust that they're going to catch you. And in a similar way, you have to trust that God's going to catch you, that He's going to be there for you. And so there's a test on that level, but also it is literally creating a new body. It's aligning you in new ways. And so I was made to get into certain yoga postures and some very, very difficult ones that ordinarily I wouldn't have been able to get into. And they were painful at the time, and yet they were necessary in order to free this body of the body consciousness and to go into pure spirit. One time I was laid down on the floor in the form of a cross with my two arms outstretched and my feet together. And I was made to arch up my back and then arch up on my tippy toes and on my fingertips, and finally my head even left the floor. Now this is not anything I could have ever done on my own, but this power was so terrific in me. And I was being crucified upon my own cross, which is this body. And so these things come, and they're perfectly tailored for each and every one of us, you see. What I go through, you may not go through in exactly the same way. And yet, you will be taken through those experiences that are perfect for you. They may test you, and they most certainly will. They'll test you to the nth degree. And yet, if you will allow yourself to go through these experiences, to allow yourself to be transformed in this kind of a way, then you will follow the way of the Christ. Now, this isn't just an individual who lived 2,000 years ago. This is a universal Christ. It is the life of all the great avatars. Avatars means descent of spirit into flesh. And it's a very specialized meaning in one way. When this world comes into a state of extreme darkness and evil has taken over, then God will directly incarnate into a body of flesh in order to help change the course of this world. But in another way, it's absolutely universal that all flesh is divinity descended into this material worldly realm, and that divinity exists inside of you. This is the message of the Gospels, the good news for all mankind. Divinity exists inside of you and may be known, may be discovered. It may be rare that individuals do this, but nevertheless, the proof is there. And it is not just for one or for two or just a few. In the Bible it says many are called, but few are chosen. And the way that I read that isn't but few are chosen, but few choose. Because if you are called, it's up to you as to whether you respond or not. And we have to go beyond the mind, you see. We can't just be armchair philosophers. We can't just read the books and become enlightened. We can't just think casually about these things and think that we're going to get the results. We can't just attend a church or a synagogue or a mosque or a temple and think that's going to do the trick, or just get baptized. You know, these early Christians, they kind of went through a test even before they got baptized, because before God in front of everybody, they'd stripped down completely nude. They were replicating themselves as Adam and Eve. And then they would get dunked into the cold water of the river. And when they came back up, you see, they were supposed to have this born-again experience. And they were given new clothes, as in new clothes in Christ. And then they were given communion, and everybody shared it together. Everybody had this unleavened bread and this wine. These are all the outer symbols, you see, of an inner process. And the outer symbols or these ceremonies are not enough to give you the complete realization. It can never happen in that way, nor can it be conferred with a degree or a certain amount of education or a doctorate or anything else. Master used to call people with theological doctorates doctors of delusion. And he told Mother, he says, when I make you a minister, I'm not looking for somebody who's just made a theological study of something. I'm looking for those who have pure hearts and are willing to go the whole way in order to realize God, that they may speak from their own experience. When Mother asked me to speak, she said, I want you to speak from your own experience. And I very rarely ever talked about my internal experiences before that. And so it was a real challenge. One is I felt they were very close and very sacred to me. And so I was reticent to bring those out into the open. And I was also shy about it. What will other people think? I had to let go of those things, you see. And so must we all. So must we all. We must come to that place. We are willing to surrender ourselves. Where we start to really fall in love with God. And that God is more important to us than anyone else. Anything else. Any object, any person, anything. Seek ye first God and His kingdom, and all these other things shall be added unto you. This is the truth. But how difficult it seems for us to put that truth into practice. And yet, if we do, we will realize the results, the promise that has been made down from the very foundation of this world. That you are in truth the living embodiment of divinity. As hard as that can seem for you to believe, because we live with ourselves, you know. We know what our own thoughts, we know what our own feelings are, we know what our own weaknesses and limitations, and we look at that and we say, that's not God, that's not divinity. And in a way, we would be right in saying so. And yet, divinity can awaken within you, in spite of your weaknesses, perhaps because of them. Because when you feel yourself as weak, as inadequate, as unknowing, and you don't just remain satisfied with that, but you surrender that to God, then God has the opportunity to come in and take control. He can take charge. And then you can really make some progress. Whenever you're faced with a problem, instead of feeling isolated from God, isn't that our tendency? We feel sorry for ourselves. We feel isolated. We feel alone. We feel that nobody understands us. And that is the greatest moment in the world. To open ourselves to this tremendous source, our source, the source of our being, of our intelligence, of our will, of our everythingness, and is also the creator of this universe. And it's a great time to open ourselves and draw more deeply from that spiritual well that's deep inside of us. And that will really help us to grow spiritually. You know, when somebody becomes depressed and very insulated and isolated, they can become so down about themselves and about the world that they want to kill themselves because they want to get rid of the pain. And that's the only way, because they're so identified with this body, that's the only way that they can think to do it. And they think that it will. But when I've talked to people, and I've down through the years, I've talked to many people who have had impulses towards suicide. So I'll ask them, what do you think will happen? Well, this body will be gone, and then I'll experience peace, and then everything will be okay. It'll be all as nothingness, and then I'll be able to rest, or I'll be in heaven, or whatever. And I said, well, what if that's not true? And they're kind of thrown back on their heels, and they say, well, what do you mean? I said, what if this is an experience that you have to fight your way through? You have to see your way through this. And if you don't do it, you'll come right back to the same point again. Only because you have taken away God's greatest gift, your life, that you've got additional karma. You've got an additional price to pay for this. Oh, well, I never thought of that. I don't like that idea very much. And they'll actually make the decision not to do it. It was an amazing thing to me how calculated taking your own life really is. We think of it as an emotional experience, but really it's a determination that we make. And so we recognize what it is that we want is we want to take away the pain of separation from God, because God is bliss itself. And we're feeling that lack of bliss, that lack of happiness that otherwise we would have. And so we must be able to break the cycle, fight our way through it, and come out on the other side, and have trust and faith that there is another side. Because when you're in that depressed, isolated state, you don't feel it. But you can hold on in faith that there is another side, and you will get to it. The opposite of that feeling of isolation is opening yourself to the abundance of God, the superior strength and power and love and intelligence of God. And you quickly admit to yourself, God, I cannot do this. I am powerless to change this. I have tried everything that I know, and I can't get it. I can't do it. You must help me. You must do this. And then we actually open ourselves. We don't remain isolated any longer. And we open ourselves to the greatness of what God is without even knowing in what way He will operate in us and through us and all around us. But what happens is we begin to see our life change. Perhaps not in a moment, but it begins to change. And if we remain in that state of openness, there is absolutely no limit to the happiness, to the bliss, to the transformation that can happen within. One of the things that God has shown me is that the closer I get to some goal, oftentimes that's when the greatest obstacles come up. And I feel the least competent, the least capable. And yet if I persevere at that time and break through that barrier, I come out on the other side stronger, and I realize that it was my very proximity to the goal that created the greatest resistance. And so if we take that principle and apply it to our spiritual lives, and you feel an extraordinary amount of resistance, and you think, aha, I'm on the precipice, I'm standing on the edge, and all I have to do is with everything in me is to take that leap, to take that jump, and trust completely in God. Now, some people stand for a long, long time standing on that edge. I remember when I was a young boy, and I went up to the high dive. It was a 10-foot high dive. And so I'm climbing behind all the other kids, and finally I get up to that platform, and I'm looking down, and 10 feet looks like forever at that point. And I don't want to do it. I'm scared. And so I turn around and all the kids are lined up behind me, all waiting in line. And I want to start climbing back down the ladder, an impossible task. And suddenly I hear the whistle blowing and the lifeguard is saying, no, you have to go off. And it was a scary moment. And so then I went and I ran and I jumped and off I went. And it was so much fun, I ran right back around and got right back in line again. But I wouldn't have had that experience of fun if the lifeguard had let me go back down at that moment. So sometimes we need a little push. We need a little shove. I used to have one of those kitchen fridge magnets that said some people need a helping hand and some people need a helping foot. And it's true, isn't it? Sometimes we need a little kick in the butt. That was something that Roy Eugene Davis told me, who's a disciple of Master. He says, we need a guru, because sometimes we need a kick in the butt. And it takes that human presence to do it, to get us off center. We're so prone to drift back into the ego center. And we're protective of ourselves. And so we have to take that leap. We have to be willing to do it. But when we do, we get this new body created brand new so that it may be a proper conduit through which all these high-powered divine energies and consciousness can flow through us, and that we have the system that it easily accommodates all of that. Now, just like when you go out and you exercise and you work your muscles, what happens? It sends a message. Oh, I need to build some more muscles here because look at, we're getting worked like this. And so the body responds by a greater blood supply, by building muscles, and that's how we get into shape, is gradually we stress the muscles. We stretch them. And as a result, they respond by getting stronger. And within your spiritual life, exactly the same thing. God will stretch you spiritually. And you respond by building spiritual muscle, spiritual blood supply, a greater sense of flow, a greater sense of strength. And you will realize that as you get down the road, that you are able to accommodate much more of this divine consciousness than you had in the past. And really, if you compare the two, you realize how much you've grown. But because you're constantly getting stretched, you're setting new goals for yourself, whether you realize it or not, that you're constantly getting stretched. So you always feel like you're at the edge of what you're able to do. But as I say, if you stretch back in time, you'll realize you are able to be so much stronger, to accommodate so much more than you ever have before. And in that way, you can recognize the progress that you have gone through time. Now, when people have difficulties in this life and they don't open themselves to God, that's when there can be real trouble, and you can get very, very lost. But when you open yourself up to this great divine transformation, you have just entered into the greatest adventure available to mankind, with the greatest results, the greatest potential, and it's all there right within you. This is a magnificent promise, and it is the truth. I can tell you that it is the truth. And in one way, you're still a human being as much as you have ever been, because you have this human body. But what you don't have, and what's changed forever, is you are never again separated from the divine consciousness from which you have come. And really, you realize that you have always existed within this divine consciousness. But you just didn't know it. Somehow you were sleepwalking to it. And now you have become awakened. That is what the Buddha means. Awakened. The awakened one. The Christ is the anointed. And it means the same thing. It is the one who has been anointed. In ancient Judaism, one of the symbolic processes that a revered king would go through is they would go through a ceremony, and then there would be oil put onto their head in recognition that they were anointed from God. And that is what the Christed One means. Now, it has a practical meaning as well, because oil is cooling. And when this kundalini heat comes up inside of you, you need to keep yourself cooled. And oil and ash are both cooling agents. And so it has a spiritual, practical meaning, as well as a symbolic meaning. And so isn't it wonderful to think of your linking back through time with all the great ones? You know, it was very interesting when Jesus was transformed upon the mountaintop, that who was seen there with him? Moses and Elisha. And you know, these great, great masters. And that he was coming in the spirit and in the power of those great masters. And the truth is, like all endeavors in this world, we stand upon the shoulders of giants, those who have gone before us. And we pay them homage. We give them their due. Because without them having gone first, we would have a much, much more difficult way of doing it. So enter into this life. Make it a love affair with God. Make God more attractive to you than anything else. When you're faced with dilemmas, open yourself more widely to what God would have for you. And you may say, well, what is it, this God? God is this presence that is beyond you, above you, uplifted. It is powerful. It is an intelligence beyond your own intelligence. And it is one of those things that when you touch it, when you experience it, you will recognize it. You will know it. And there's no amount of explaining that will give you a window into that experience other than to say that when you get it, you know it, you feel it, you experience it. And when you get that experience, you want more of it, I will guarantee you. We have a new Cross and Lotus journal out, and I just wanted to close, and then I'll open it up to any questions you might have about your sadhana. But I wanted to close with this Manash Shloka by Smarta Ramdas. It's not Papa Ramdas, it's a saint from before. He lived in 1608 to 1681. And he writes, when actions and speech do not harmonize, the mind gets corrupted and puts one to shame. Uncontrolled, undisciplined, it wanders here and there. How can such a person expect to attain God? Reflect and introspect. Change your way of life. Live with pure actions and goodness. Let your words and actions be in harmony. O mind, give up imaginary sorrows and broodings. Adhere faithfully to your traditional worship. Discriminate, O mind. Be alert and do not waver. Have compassion towards all beings and creatures. Such a devout person experiences peace in daily life. O mind, do not sow the seeds of anger, but seek the company of virtuous people and saints. And do not stay with vicious people, O mind. Detach from samsara and become fit for liberation. So wonderful discussion with your own mind, with his own mind. And so let us open it up now if there are things about your own practice, about your own sadhana, any questions that you might have at this time. Swimmingly well, living in bliss. And if not, why not?
say something about surrendering, David, mm-hmm. because the last 4 or 5 days just hanging out with you guys, and what's the program? You know? And it's wonderful to practice surrendering.
Mm-hmm. When we traveled with Marge Ranny, she'd always start every day, "What's the program today? What's the program?" That was her wording for it. And I'd say, "Ram is our program." "Oh, I know. But what's the program?" Ram. That, how much relief it is when you don't have to micromanage your own life. And it's not that we don't make any plans and that we don't keep any appointments, anything like that. Life could get rather chaotic if we didn't have any of that. But there's a certain place inside that we let go. And we trust that things are working out as they should. This does not mean that we can be careless around our commitments. If we make commitments, we should strive to keep them. And we can't make plans. We can make plans. But as Mother said, make a skeletal plan. And then let God fit in all the details. And if God decides to take away the whole skeletal plan and redesign something new, then that's all right too. And our need for structure oftentimes is driven by a sense of insecurity and fear. And that is the real problem, because that is separation from God. And so when we identify it as such and say, "All right, I have this insecurity, I have this fear," then what's the solution to that? Then I must turn my attention towards God and really learn to trust in Him. So many people today live with an underlying anxiety all the time. There's an anxiety that's running in the background, just like a program on your computer that's constantly taking energy from your computer, that it's running that program, and it can deplete your batteries and use you up. And it's not how we're designed to live. We're designed to live in freedom. And in bliss, and in peace. So if we have that anxiety, we have to go to work on it. And once we identify it, then to keep the mind upon God, chanting God's name, meditating more deeply, watching the breath, bringing that mind into that stillness, until we have that peace and we have it as our constant and abiding friend. And that will really be a new body created in the mind and in the energy body and in the physical body. Chanting is a wonderful way to an antidote to anxiety. And then, as Bhapa talked about, remembering the qualities of God. So as you chant, just thinking, "God, you are all powerful. You are all knowing. You are all loving." And this has a wonderful effect upon the mind, that as you repeat these qualities of God, you find yourself settling down, and your whole body settles down, and you're able to have a sense of peace that before was unavailable.
Something in the Cross and Lotus about work, mm-hmm. doing the right work, this issue.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things I had was, I'm fairly familiar with the idea of working in the world.
Yeah.
By not working in the world, I feel a little funny about it because you think you're capable of it. You perhaps you should be doing it, but mm-hmm. there's other types of work that is equally and perhaps more important.
And harder.
Yeah. And so the real key in that is, am I doing what I am meant to do in this time? So there's a wonderful story about this young monk who arrived at this temple. And the temple was sponsored by a man of great wealth. And he was a businessman and a man of doing in the material world. So he thought of himself as being quite virtuous and good in supporting this temple, and that was the right thing to do. But he would come and visit this temple, and he'd see this young man over there meditating. And he'd think, after a while, you know, I never see him helping around the ashram. I never see him doing anything. And he had a low opinion of him. And he brooded on this, and it bothered him. And so finally, he just got a little bit fed up with it. And he went to this fellow, and he says, listen, he says, everybody else around here all works. And you don't do anything. And, you know, if you don't start doing something, I think you should just leave this ashram. Because I'm not here to support just, you know, anybody who just wants to sit around on their duff all day. So the young man said, well, that's all right. If you want to ask me to go, that's fine. But I'd like you to try something first. He says, I just want you to sit with me for the next 5 minutes. Just sit quietly. I don't have time for that. I'm a busy man, and my time is worth money, and I'm not just going to sit around like you do all day. No, just 5 minutes. 5 minutes, just sit down. So finally he talked him into it. He sits down. It's the longest 5 minutes this businessman has ever spent in his entire life, trying to quiet his mind down, trying to sit like that. And suddenly it dawned on him, this is extremely hard work. And he had a newfound appreciation for this young man who was centering his life in this kind of a way and bringing it into this state of stillness and this peace. And so with that newfound appreciation, he says, all right, my friend, you stay. You're benefiting this entire ashram by what you're doing. There's a young woman at an anandashram, and she eventually asked that I become her guru, but she was telling someone else, she says, I don't know what it is about the other people come into the office, and sometimes they offer to help and things like that. When he comes in, all the work just seems to go more smoothly. So, you don't know the effect that your practice has, not only on yourself, but on this world as well. And so the only key in there is this is what God has called me to at this time. And one of the great challenges can be it takes you out of your normal routine. And how do we find value in ourselves? Well, when we get together with friends, what do we talk about? Well, I do such and such a profession. And how do we get value oftentimes is that I have so many possessions, or I make so much money, and that gives me some place in this world. And all of those frames of reference get stripped away. That's hard work, really. It's a letting go of all those familiar things. And suddenly you're in an unfamiliar world, in an unfamiliar sea. So in the Vedas, there's 3-4 different times within a lifetime. And the first 25 years is being a student, learning about life, learning about a vocation, learning about God, and then how to take that into your family life. And that's the next. And you enter into family life and into business, and that's the next stage of your life. The third stage is when your children have grown old enough to take care of themselves, maybe take over the business or whatever, then you let that go. And now you're in a time of deepening your practice of the teachings. That's the third stage.
And the fourth stage is having an attainment in that, and you live in a fairly isolated kind of life in that complete state of stillness. And so you have those four stages. And so when we shift from that stage of being very active, 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 and suddenly not active, all the motor, you know, there's a momentum in that motor that keeps on going towards activity. And then, if, you know, how to identify who I am in this world. And I have a home, and I have a business, and I, you know, this is, these are integral parts to how I define myself. Suddenly stripped away, gone. And so, rather than going with that momentum and the racing mind, it's to say, go inside, say, all right, is this what I'm intended to do now? And if the answer comes back and says yes, all right, then my job, and it's hard work, is to come into that still state, that quietness, to get my oneness with God. So Lari Mahasya talks about karma yoga, which we normally think of as service to other people. He says kriya yoga is karma yoga. It's an activity. In fact, kriya is built into the root of activity. That's the same root word, comes from both. So it's a practice, that's your work then. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I like that, at this time.
Yeah, at this time. That's all we know. That's all we know. I remember when I went and took the year of silence and solitude. And I knew that when I finally arrived, because I was doing a lot of traveling and talking beforehand, I knew that there would be a momentum of energy from that. And sure enough, I arrived there, and I just needed to let it unwind. And it took 2 or 3 weeks, and for all that energy just to settle down, and for me to settle down, and just really arrive and be there from a state of high activity to a place of just, and it's amazing when you're in a place of solitude and silence like that, there's no getting up and going to the store, even to pick up some things to eat. There's no nothing. Complete. You're there. You're present to what is. And so you arrive. And the more you arrive, and the more you deepen into that, the greater the stillness, and then the greater the realization that comes from that. But as the wealthy businessman turned out, it was a lot more work than what he gave it credit for. It's amazing how powerful this world is on us. What a force it exerts on us constantly. Doing, 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 doing. We could spend an entire life complete doing and never learn anything about just being. What? What's it worth? What? How's that going to pay me? That's the material mind. And then we wake up from this world and all the material things that we did, and we look back on this. So much of that was wasted. So much worry, so much anxiety, so much desire for what? It's all gone. Filled up.
This practicing the presence of God, I think it's very challenging.
I think you're right.
this week, you know, has been a big week for me with moving and trying to rent my condo, and there's just been a lot of tremendous amount of activity, and it's been challenging in trying to get things done to keep that.
Right.
And I don't know that I did a really great job.
So the question becomes, is it possible? Is it possible to be in the world but not of the world? Mm. And what would you say? Is it possible, based on your own experience?
Well, I know at times it's been possible.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, maybe it's just like lifting weights. You know, you only can lift 10, you know, you lift 10 pounds and then... And you keep working at it and you live.
Well, another way of looking at it, what are you doing when you are in the world but not of the world? What allows that to happen?
Be willing to have it be any way that it is.
Okay. Okay. And within that, I would take it, you would still have some desire nature, some, you know, I'd like to see it go in this direction. But it may not go in that direction, or not in that moment, at least. And so willingness then to release your grip on that to some extent. So what would be the opposite? When you're not able or allowing yourself to be in the world but not of the world, and you get caught up by the world, what are you doing then?
Well, I mean, the first thing I think about is like having a deadline. Having you know, a day and time when something is supposed to be done.
Right.
You know, and maybe there's other people involved in the situation.
Right.
And
so that, the deadline and the other people draws you out into the world and you divorce yourself from yourself.
Right. It gets so over there that there's nothing.
There's nothing there. There's no awareness there. You're all out there.
Yeah.
So I just want you to imagine, if you had a deadline and there are other people involved, could you see yourself remaining centered here, even with a deadline, even with other people involved?
I mean, I can.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. How does that feel?
Well, when I do that, it feels very calm and peaceful.
So then the key is to do more of that. Just do more of that. And dedicate yourself to doing more of that. And yes, there will be times when you will not do that. And then you draw yourself back and you look, okay, I was doing really well up until I got that phone call.
Yeah.
Or I did really good until it became the day of that deadline. And I just increasingly, I could feel where I lost it. And then you learn from that. And you say, okay, I need to be particularly careful with that. Or I did really well until this certain person came into the picture. And it seems like their anxiety, I pick up on their anxiety. And I start acting out their anxiety, even though it's not my own. So when I get around that person, I really need to work on remaining in myself. And letting their anxiety just go right on by, disappear over the horizon, just goes right on by. I don't need to be a sponge and soak that up. And I breathe, and I remain centered. And you just keep practicing, and keep practicing. And you're right, it's not easy. It's hard work.
Well, and especially I find it very challenging when it occurs that a lot has to be done in a short period.
And I'm here to tell you that no matter what your worldly situation is, you can remain in that centered place and that things go better from a worldly standpoint. You're not depleted of energy. You make fewer mistakes. That in a calm mind, you're more open to good reasoning and also intuition. And you're not wasting your energy, depleting it on a lot of worry and anxiety and all the rest of it. You set better priorities. So from a very practical, worldly standpoint, it's an extremely valuable practice to do. From a spiritual standpoint, it's absolutely necessary. So it's keeping the work up. Is that the answer you wanted to hear?
Well, I notice that I want to have like specific things that I should do. Like when I notice that I'm trying to go faster, that maybe I should
breathe.
Just go slower.
Breathe, go half time.
Yeah.
Half speed. And you think, well, I don't have time to go half speed. If anything, I need to go kick it in the gear. Right? And it's amazing when you breathe and you go 3/4 speed or half speed, you get everything done. And you make fewer mistakes. It was so irritating to me when I would go drive vehicle with my brother and he'd drive another vehicle. He's an extremely slow and cautious driver and I'm zooming through traffic and cutting in and out of planes and, you know, I finally get there, you know, and he comes pulling right up behind me. What's that? He's all calm, you know, and I'm all, my shoulders are all tightened up, you know. I've been driving like crazy to get there, and probably half the people have cursed me along the way. He's just calmly. And it's amazing. And the very big thing is we make fewer mistakes. We drop fewer things. We bump into fewer things. We make better priorities. It's very, very practical. It really is. And so you breathe, shift into lower gear, and do one thing at a time. One thing. It's amazing, we're balancing 10 things up here. Oh, I got to do this and this and this, and we carry around that with us all day long. No wonder we're exhausted at the end of the day. I shift into here, one thing at a time. That's all I can do. And I'm breathing. And I'm present.
And bringing your energy down to your dante and down to your like belly. So the lower you can get to the ground, the more present you can be. So like you were saying, when you're up here and you're thinking about all the things you have to do, if you just can bring it down here, you can be present.
So like that? So does that sound practical?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I just have to remember.
That's correct. That's correct. So sometimes it helps us to put reminders around, you know, some picture or some saying or something that would just help us, you know. And it's just remembering. It's just remembering and bringing ourselves back to it. You can also rehearse in advance. If you know you're going into a situation that's traditionally a place where you get triggered, you see yourself doing it in that very centered, very balanced kind of way, the whole way. You practice it in your mind. And it's like the gymnasts at the Olympics. You know, you watch them and they're, before they do their routine, they're, you know, they're standing there doing all of this. They're doing their whole routine in their head, seeing themselves do it perfectly all the way through. So you do it in advance. You see yourself rehearsing the whole thing and doing it in that calm, centered kind of way. And you're giving instructions to your subconscious mind. This is how I want to do it. We're really not meant to live in a state of anxiety continuously. And it wears us out. It wears out our health. It wears us out mentally and emotionally. It's hard. And yet you look around and you see how many people do exactly that.
Well, I've been doing that.
Yeah. Yeah. And we all have. And we all have. So, but you can change that. Great. Okay. I'd like you to just close your eyes.
And that image that I described before, that those two filaments coming up your spine, just like the light bulb, and you see the life energy and feel the life energy. Some people are stronger at feeling than they are at seeing. And these are interchangeable. You can see with your feeling and you can feel with your seeing. And you see and feel that life energy coming up your spine. Those two filaments up to the top of your head. And it brings a light into your whole being, all along your spine and particularly at the top of your head. And in your mind's eye, see that light just glowing. Just glowing. And radiating out to your whole body and bringing with it a sense of peace. A sense of knowingness. A knowingness that God is present within you and all is well. Whatever your worldly circumstances tell you, all is well. And then see that light going out and filling up this room and all the people in it. And then to continue to see that light expanding out to this whole community, to this whole town, and blessing all the people in that feeling of calm, that feeling of light, that feeling of assurance. And then going out particularly to this world, to all your loved ones, anyone you may have particular worries about, concerns about, and see them with that same capacity for that life energy to come into them, to light up the bulb of their own being, and that they might find that peace and that knowingness and knowing that all is well. And then to see this world as a tiny bubble in a sea, and it is all radiating with that same light, and that this world is bathed in that light, and that all the world knows that all is well, all is well. And as Papa Ram Dass says, the world is God. The world is God. It is made up of God's stuff, of light. And that that light can continue to expand out and out and out until this whole universe is just a little island in the great sea of consciousness and is filled with that light. And that there are many island universes, all filled with light. And that you are more vast, more expansive than all those island universes. And you are that. You are that. Om Tat Sat. Father, Son, Holy Ghost. Om Tat Sat. Blessings of the Divine be ever upon you.